Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode number 22, titled The Fundamental Misknowing.
Now, the Tibetan tradition, therefore, in its original form in Buddhism, is considered one of the most important things. The Buddha drew on the... It said the one thing that the Buddha wrote in his lifetime after being a Buddha. Before he was a Buddha, he wrote as a prince, of course. But after being a Buddha, he didn't write anything, supposedly. There's a tradition like that. But except he drew in the sand a wheel with 12 spokes. And this was the wheel of dependent origination, Pratitya Samutpada. And it ends with what we are confronted with, which is life. So the 12th step of it is old age and death. And the 11th step is birth. The 10th step, going backwards, is conception, existence, they say, or sense of being. You know, it's bhava, actually. It's the same word. Then the step before that is grasping or taking or, grasping. And before that is, the 9 is grasping, 8 is craving, I hope. Lemba, I think so. Yeah. Oh, somebody got with him. What?
It is craving.
What?
Craving.
Yeah, craving, that's right. Oh, good, I'm right, 8 is craving. 7th is contact, I think. I'm are you sure? 7th is contact?
Isn't feeling...
What? Do you have it there?
Isn't it feeling?
What?
It's feeling.
I have contact, feeling...
Feel, see, grasping. Feel, that's right.
Yeah, craving.
Feel, contact is 6th then. Feeling is 7th?
Yeah.
8th is craving. Okay. Yeah. And then, all right? So 6th is contact. 5th is the sixfold sense organization. Yeah. The 6 media, I like to call them, the 6 media of sense, right? The 4th is name and form. The 3rd is consciousness. The 2nd is something like activities or functions or operation, samskara, meaning to, like, you know, creation, even you could say. Samskara is something that's translated as creational activity. And then the 1st is ignorance. So what is interesting is that, and this again, I think we discussed this a little bit last night, this again has to do with the fact that when our human curiosity, our consciousness, our awareness wants to try to understand something, what we try to understand about it is how it has came to be, how it is made. You know, you want to find out its origin and its source. This is like how human curiosity works, probably monkeys too. You want to find out how something happened or how it is made. So you go back looking for the cause. That's why in all theologies, etc., the idea of creation is a big deal, and why all authorities try to pretend that they know how things are created. Do you know what I mean? So the scientists were floundering around feeling nervous until they came up with the Big Bang. Then they could hold off the Pope. Do you know what I mean? And the religious people who claim to know how that, you know, God created it and all this, you know, the uncaused cause and all that sort of thing, which is the irrational idea. So, the unmoved mover, you know, that sort of thing. So in doing that, when you go back through a cycle from the existing life, which means old age and death, and birth, from birth to old age and death, that's life, that's 11 and 12, and then you go back through that series of mental things, going back to the individuated consciousness, and then the creative activity. But then when its source is ignorance, what does that mean in a way? It means that really it's dependent on origination. In other words, the origination is an error. It's based on error. It's based on misunderstanding. If you understand, nothing was created, actually. So even in the realist schools, who think of it as a kind of way of understanding the way that when they meditate on it, it is said, for example, that the Pratyeka Buddha, which means something like the Hermit Buddha, who is a being who becomes enlightened to a certain degree without meeting a Buddha in a particular world or era or whatever, or nation or culture. But he does so because he or she does so because they somehow heard or remembered from previous life or run into in a text those 12 links of dependent origination, as it is called. And then they get back into that basic thing that the origin of things is ignorance. Not knowing, or misknowing, as I prefer to translate it. And what is the misknowing? The misknowing is, what is the fundamental misknowing about each of us in the Buddha's analysis? Each of us knows what? What does everybody in this room know? What?
Our own subjective existence.
Well, we know that we exist.
Yes.
And this is the place where our absolutism is really most powerful. Is, you know, like Descartes beautifully illustrated. He got back to that thing of like, you know, I'm doubting, therefore I exist. You know, like I'm thinking, therefore I exist. In other words, this feeling of the sort of irreducibility of my own subjective being. Which is what death then becomes such a big problem for, because then that's canceled that. But and that then seems to be absolute loss to us, because we think of that as absolute reality. And that, however, is the fundamental misknowledge in Buddha's view. From that misknowledge, then the world springs forth, and we functional activity, differentiation of self and other, consciousness of subjectivity, of objects that are not the self, then name and form, meaning sort of differentiation between matter and mind. Name is encompassed, mind is encompassed by name, by language. And then the sense organs emerge from that, and they are sense of objective spheres. Then contact between the subject and object through the senses, the mind being a sixth sense, and the mental object being a sixth object. Feeling is a bad translation, sensation, pleasure, pain, or numbness. It isn't emotion. You know, feeling has that double meaning in English of emotion, so therefore Vedana should not really be translated feeling as people do. It really is sensation. And then craving, because then you want the pleasant one, not the unpleasant sensation. You want pleasure, not pain. And then grasping for what you think will bring that through the craving, and then coming to a state of existence, and then being born, and then dying, and then it goes round and round. Yes?
Discrimination, is that contact?
They have something called discrimination in there?
No, I mean like the idea of that, isn't that?
Well, no, discrimination comes right with right from the ignorance.
Yeah.
The ignorance itself, the misknowing, is a kind of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of thinking, I'm something different from the world.
Oh, okay.
So that's the fundamental one. And then that elaborates itself in terms of functioning activities, and then there's awareness of a subjective with the dichotomously separated from the objects, etc. And then those elaborate into an embodiment. And they have this about formation of the mind in the womb, you know, coming from the 10 stages. This 12 links is used, and it's used biologically, physically, it's used in many ways. But the fact that it reaches, the base reasoning is the creator of the universe is ignorance. Of the relative is a very key point. And then that leads to the Madhyamaka thing, which is the non-origination of all things, which is a strange idea. And then when one first gets deeper with that idea, one develops what is called a tolerance of the birthlessness of all things. And then that tolerance becomes a positive awareness. And that's it. And what that means is that on the level of where we habitually perceive self and other as having intrinsic reality by instinctive habit, right, which we have. On that level, when we keep examining things, investigating them to see if that intrinsic reality holds up under analysis, and as it keeps dissolving, then what we come up with is that emptiness of that intrinsic reality. And then there's a very deep point there where that emptiness, in other words, the emptiness, we realize emptiness only by not being able to find the non-emptiness. So it's a negational realization. It, you know, like a negative realization, like for example, when you realize that there's no elephant in the room, It isn't really any determined, it's not a sort of seemingly, it's a kind of open-ended realization. Because there's still, somebody could be wearing a charm bracelet with a little elephant on it that you might not have seen. But, you know, you think, well, I'm not really looking for an image of an elephant. I'm looking for a real one, like an animal going trumpeting and, you know, slurping around with its nose, its trunk. And there's now no room for one, and I've looked everywhere, and then there's no elephant. So they're not. But that's a that. And this, so the cognition of the lack of elephant is different than if I see an elephant, which sort of seems to be terminated at a certain moment. But the non-elephant is a different kind, and it just sort of opens into that. And then you sort of make a decision. Well, I've looked enough. You know, the criteria for that would be that that would enable an elephant to be here have been fully thought through, and I have looked and investigated, and there is none. So that's the way emptiness is understood, in other words. It's not understood, that, you know, but when you viscerally do that, you come into experiences that are seemingly like nothingness-type experiences. Things seem to melt away and dissolve or become transparent, it is said. And that's considered almost a danger, because then what happens, what should happen, if you're properly, if you have the wisdom born of learning, is that your inquiring mind will not find any other thing that looks like it's intrinsically real, except you think you've found the intrinsic reality of it all, which is the emptiness you think you've found. That mind will continue to go without needing another sentence or phrase or a syllogism or an inference, and that emptiness itself will then be looked for, and it will not be found. And so that's called the emptiness of emptiness. The lack of that emptiness is the intrinsic reality of other things, in a way you can say, but it itself has no intrinsic reality either. That's very important. Yes?
Is that a danger, though? I would think that would be part of using the same critical method.
Oh, it is.
The emptiness, what you did to everything else.
Yeah, it is. But when you come at it meditatively, as a sequence of experiences, then there is this great danger and temptation to think when... Because when you do, when you're looking for an intrinsic reality, so when you're looking for selflessness, you're not looking for selflessness. What looking for selflessness is looking for the self.
And not finding it.
Or looking for intrinsic realitylessness or emptiness is not looking for that, it's looking for intrinsic realities.
Yeah.
And then they dissolve under analysis. And so you didn't find them. And then that not finding them is a finding of emptiness, they say. But then at a point, you run out of things which you might be ascribing to intrinsic reality. You accept emptiness itself, because things seem to have dissolved around you, and you seem to have dissolved. And it's very key at that time that you don't then think mistakenly that I now have achieved emptiness. That's very dangerous. Yes?
What I don't understand is how that's more useful in sort of seeking this concept of enlightenment.
Sorry, how? What?
How it's more useful in achieving this concept of enlightenment than any other emotion or knowledge-based thing? Because isn't it still a subjective, whatever the perception?
Oh, you were the one doing on the subjective. That's good. You see, the subjective business, the subjective thing is that's the most key place where we attribute a self is to ourself, where we absolutize the self. That is the absolute source of suffering. Is the absolutization of the self. Because subliminally and instinctively, everybody here, unless somebody happens to be enlightened, in which case I apologize for lumping you in with the rest of us, but everybody here instinctively feels an absoluteness about their own existence. So they self are. Everyone here is subject to the self-absolutization habit, let's call it. So the key is to look for that if the self is there. Therefore, the meditation on the selflessness of the self is to look for that absolute self. And the process of doing it is like, well, if we come to acknowledge in ourselves that I'm absolutely thinking I'm here, and then the Buddha's teaching of selflessness or Nagarjuna's teaching of voidness, emptiness, is not really like we're supposed to agree with it. We don't actually agree with it. It's a challenge. And then if we think, well, those people were pretty interesting, actually, and they seem to be pretty together. So if they're saying that my feeling of being absolutely here is something mistaken, then that's something I have to take pretty seriously. But the first step in taking it seriously is admitting that I don't agree with that, at least not in the sense of how I feel.
Yeah,
So precisely, you know, you will get down to the Descartesian thing where everything else will dissolve under analysis, and then there's still that feeling of the absolute self being there, which is then he started from there. You know, he discarded everything, res extensa, very brilliantly, just like any Buddhist yogi. But then he took this present sense self of self-presence, which he also admitted he couldn't find. He tried very hard, but he couldn't actually catch himself. But then he thought, well, I'm trying to catch myself, so that's being there. So I can't doubt that, right? So I have to acknowledge that. So that was, in a way, the beginning of the examination of selflessness. He needed a Zen master to give him a whack on the head when he said, cogito ergo sum. In the sense that, not in the sense, cogito ergo sum is actually correct too, interestingly. But not as an absolute.
It's just part of...
Cogito as a relative, as a relational. In other words, acknowledging the non-finding. You see, the inability to find means that it isn't there in the way we thought it was there. But when we think, in a way, we're relationally there. So then in a illusory, erroneous, illusory means it seems to be, but it isn't the way it is. But yet it is an existence of an illusion in a way, you could say. Therefore, illusory is the word. So that is there. So you see, there in a way, what does an expression an infinite whole mean? How can there be an infinite whole? The dichotomous concept of whole and part dissolves in the context of infinity in a way, which is a negational. Infinity is a negative word. I mean, you never reach infinity, right? Even although you also never can avoid infinity. You realize we're all infinite right now, right? Because we can't exclude our finitude, does not exclude infinity, because if it did, it wouldn't be infinite, right? Although it would seem to be they should be opposite. I'm finite and there's something that's infinite. But if there's something that's infinite, I'm infinite, because it can't keep out of me. Do you know what I'm saying? So that's in that same kind of area. But what was it, your real problem? You kept saying, I will do well to recognize fully the way in which we are the authors of the play as we see it performed, strengthen the self, diminish self-doubt, replace it with confidence, self-awareness, and then begin to dismantle the attachment to the play itself. Well,
I don't know if that's mine.
What?
That's Jane.
That's not you? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's another one. That's a good one, too. Oh, yeah, here. The assumption that the subjective life is real only in a relative, non-intrinsic, or self-standing way is in conflict with the idea of practicable and practically attainable Buddhahood. Well, precisely, the opposite is correct from what you're saying. If the subjective life were real in an intrinsic way, that's what would be opposite from practicable and practically attainable. Because if you were intrinsically what you are, and if you are unenlightened, then you're intrinsically unenlightened, then that enlightenment is your intrinsic essence, and your intrinsic reality, then you'll never become enlightened, because that intrinsic thing is not relational and therefore it can never change. Right? So in a way, it's a very easy. The idea of lack of intrinsic reality is incredibly easy. It's almost obvious. It's almost tautological. How can any relative thing have intrinsic reality, have non-relative reality? Then it wouldn't be there. You follow me? But the fact that people come up with all these theories about essentialism or intrinsic reality or whatever, essentialism is why, you know, Garfield is using the term for the Sambhava, means that people's instinctive feeling is that I'm really here in a really absolute way, and there's something irreducible and absolutely me about me, undetermined and unaffected by circumstance. And therefore, when I look at myself in a family photo at the age of 4, I'm completely puzzled about who is that little, like, thing. And as you look, and as you grow older, you look at yourself in the mirror, you wonder, who is that? Because you always just feel the same way, because you have this absolutized sense of self that seems instinctively to you never to change. But actually, anybody else will tell you it's totally changing.
Well, I guess so the thing is,
so the fact that you're free from that is what enables you to be more and more fully relational.
But if we're not You know, if there's nothing intrinsic, how can there be change? You know, how can relative experiences have a sense?
That's the only thing that can change is what's non-intrinsic. What is interrelated with other things is what changes. Right?
Yeah. But there's an extent to which isn't meditation simply grounding you as a subject because you are subject meditating on...
But where does it look for your subject then apart from objects? Try to find it.
Well, it's not apart from...
You're being very good in the sense of you're realizing that you feel you have a subjectivity that is apart from objects. And somehow you think that's what you have to cling to, that subjectivity, philosophically. So that means you're being aware of your own intrinsic self-absolutization habit pattern. But then the key, if you're going to accept the challenge, is find it then.
Well, I don't think there's any realness to this subject.
Any what? Realistic subject?
I don't think there's any intrinsic subject.
Oh, you don't?
The question is...
Well, then what's the problem?
If there is none, then how can you get outside of that? Because...
If there was, you wouldn't be able to. Therefore, there isn't one.
But if we're using...
Therefore, the habit that we feel that we do have one is what is causing all the trouble. You see, like right here, we have 30 people, or whatever number. Each one is really real. The real person here. Now, who's wrong? Like, and each one of us thinks the others are not really real. They're just like over there somewhere. And yet each one is, and so each of us is the center of the event. Edward is the intrinsic subjectivity around here. Or Bob is. Or whoever else. But to the other people, no way. So everyone is in this error of feeling they're the real thing here. And then that makes everyone paranoid. Because we all know that no one else agrees with us. Right?
Well, I agree with all this.
Oh, yeah, well, what's your problem then?
I don't know.
No, you're right. You see, you agree, I agree. It's almost, as I said, it's almost simplistic. But we don't feel that way.
But isn't feeling just another, it's no further towards enlightenment because it's just an emotion, it's just a sensation.
Exactly. Well, I don't mean by feeling by emotion. I mean we have a sense of our own self-centrality. It's called the intrinsic identity habit. The Buddhists have the most fantastic analytical terminologies about all of these kind of instinctive self-centeredness that we have. And that's what we're working with here. And the key, though, is to bring them up and to realize that we do have them and then critically seek to verify them. And then what's liberating is if we fail to verify them and we sustain that failure and we in a way, come to where that failure becomes itself something. And then you see that you say that we should be self-confident. All this, no, that was another person, but you said the only conceivable way around this is how can the boundaries of something be shaped away if the means are you seeking for knowledge through self-expression as the subject simply reinforces one's existence as such? But the point is, when you self-explore yourself as a subject, it doesn't reinforce your existence as an intrinsically real self because you can't find that, is what you'll find. And so that then opens the sense of self and therefore deepens one's sense of interconnectedness. That's key. And that's why in the verse, he salutes Nagarjuna, and rather he salutes also the Buddha, he says, crown of all teachers for teaching the emptiness. Another translation of emptiness, by the way, could be freedom. Freedom is also a negative word. You know, you say sugar-free, salt-free, stress-free, hassle-free. That means lacking. But we think of freedom in America especially as like, I don't know, somebody win a football game, you got freedom, or George Bush shouting about freedom. But freedom is actually just a negational term. It doesn't really refer to anything. It refers to lack of something, lack of bondage. So the freedom from intrinsic reality, that means relativity, you see. So the equivalence of voidness and relativity is for that teaching, that's where Buddha was unique among the ancient philosophers. Because otherwise they thought, well, if things aren't really there, then how could they really relate? And they all have like essences and the pure forms, you know, Socrates and Plato has, and etc. Everybody's got some kind of Dingan Zik hanging around. And the Buddhists, and most of the Buddhists have. Only the Prasangi, you know, the most subtle levels of the Madhyamaka. And even Nagarjuna and the other teachers, along with himself, they warn that the sort of most radical, most relativistic, you know, deconstructive type of emptiness level insight, one must be careful about it if it seems to one that that voidness becomes nothing nihilistic. In other words, there's a big danger of becoming nihilistic. And therefore, if you need to keep a little intrinsic reality in things, a little degree of intrinsicity in things to kind of feel solid about them, do so. There's a wonderful, it's like a philosophical therapy. Don't push too fast and think you can jump into the void. Don't think you have a hold of the void. That's a terrible danger. That makes you crazy. I understand emptiness. I did understand it. I had an experience of it. Therefore, I'm cool, no matter what. That's wrong. That's a badness. That's a disease. In Zen, that's called being stuck in the demon ghost cave. I like that. Zen is very fun, very graphic.